Welcome, everyone, to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, your guide, ready to unpack some of the most compelling stories, insights, and surprising facts from today's news.
And I'm Sam Astor, the expert, here to help connect the dots and explore the deeper implications of the crucial information we're about to explore.
Today, we're taking a deep dive into the Wall Street Journal for Tuesday, August 26th, 2025. We got a packed agenda traversing everything from the inner workings of the White House and the Federal Reserve
to the future of AI, global conflicts, and even the evolving world of personal finance.
Our mission, as always, is to give you a shortcut to being truly well-informed, providing those aha moments that make complex topics click.
Exactly.
So grab your favorite beverage, get comfortable, because we're about to jump into a fascinating journey through today's top stories. Okay, let's unpack this. From administration's domestic and economic agenda, power plays, and policy shifts. All right, first up, we're starting off in the heart of Washington, D.C. We're looking at some truly high-stakes political maneuvers and policy shifts.
Yeah, these are already, you know, shaking up the domestic and economic landscape quite a bit.
Let's talk about the Federal Reserve first. There's some major drama unfolding around Fed Governor Lisa Cook.
Right. President Trump has publicly attempted to remove her.
Which seems like a significant escalation of his, well, longstanding campaign against the central bank.
It is. And this is really more than just a political skirmish. It feels like a direct challenge to the Fed's long-held independence.
Which is bedrock, isn't it, for economic stability?
Absolutely. And what's truly insidious here is how these seemingly isolated attacks on individual Fed governors.
Yeah.
They don't just threaten their positions.
Right.
More importantly, they erode the perception of independence.
Ah, okay. The perception itself.
That perception is almost as vital as its actual independence, you know, because the market reacts not just to facts, but to belief. And this constant chipping away could have a far greater long-term destabilizing effect than, say, any single policy change.
And the details here are quite pointed, aren't they? President Trump's letter to Governor Cook posted on social media.
Yeah, it cited sufficient cause for her removal.
And this came after allegations from Bill Polt, the Federal Housing Finance Agency leader.
That's right. Polt claimed Cook described two properties, one in Michigan, another in Atlanta, as primary residences within 14 days of each other, back in 2021 mortgage papers.
Wow. And Polt even said he'd refer this to the Justice Department for a criminal investigation.
He did. Governor Cook's response, though, was immediate and unyielding.
What did she say?
She flatly stated President Trump has no authority to fire her and made it clear she will not resign.
Okay.
Her lawyer, Abby Lowell, echoed this, calling the move flawed and lacking proper legal basis.
So this sets up, a very interesting legal battle, especially given the historical ambiguity around a president's power to actually fire a sitting Fed governor.
Exactly. Their terms extend well beyond presidential terms. In Cook's case, until 2038.
Right. And this action against Cook, it isn't an isolated incident, is it?
No, not at all. It's really the most dramatic escalation of President Trump's broader campaign against the Fed.
He's previously targeted Chair Jerome Powell, right, for not cutting interest rates.
Mm-hmm. And criticized alleged mismanagement of the D.C. headquarters renovation.
So insults have flown before, but this move against Cook, it pushes the boundaries further.
It really does. And we've also seen initial reactions from lawmakers falling, as you'd expect, along clear partisan lines. Senator Rick Scott publicly backing Trump, for instance.
Which just points to a continued politicization of what's traditionally meant to be a nonpartisan institution.
Precisely.
So what are the potential impacts here? I mean, if this attempted ousting were somehow to succeed,
well, if successful, it would create an opening for Trump to appoint a new governor.
Yeah.
That could potentially shift the board's majority.
Hmm.
Already you have Trump appointees Michelle Bowman and Christopher Waller dissenting on interest rate decisions, aligning with the president's preference for cuts.
And there's another Trump nominee, Stephen Marin, waiting for confirmation.
Right. So gaining Cook's seat could give Trump appointees a majority, and that could fundamentally alter the Fed's direction.
Okay, so that's the immediate potential impact.
Yes, but this also brings us to a crucial historical parallel. This Fed bashing actually has deep roots in American populism.
Oh, like what?
Think back to Andrew Jackson's war against Nicholas Biddle and the Second Bank of the United States back in the 1830s.
That is a deep cut into history. What are the parallels between Jackson's era and, well, today's make-a populism and Trump's criticisms?
Jackson's presidency was largely defined by his battle with the central bank, much like what we're seeing play out now.
Okay.
Then, as now, the populist agenda combined three distinct elements. First, a strong demand for cheap money and abundant credit, especially from those on the economic frontier looking to expand.
Right, easier money.
Second, a deep suspicion of fiat money and the power of the financial elite, a wariness of banks concentrating power.
Uh-huh. Anti-elite sentiment.
And third, a push for an America-first approach to monetary policy, prioritizing domestic needs over, say, international financial health.
Okay, so how does that map onto today?
Well, if you look at today, President Trump's urgent calls for interest rate cuts directly reflect that demand for soft money, right?
Mm-hmm.
The broader cryptocurrency movement, which, as we'll discuss later, Eric Trump is heavily involved in, embodies a similar suspicion of fiat money and a desire to decentralize credit creation.
Interesting connection.
And finally, complaints about the strong dollar's impact on American producers, coupled with demands for high tariffs regardless of global consequences, that clearly echoes that America First economic policy.
Wow. It's a remarkably consistent playbook, as you say.
It is.
So Jackson won his bank war. What happened then? And what might be the consequences now?
Jackson's victory led to an immediate boom, especially in underdeveloped regions, the West and South. But that boom ended in tears. The Panic of 1837 triggered the most severe depression Americans had experienced up to that point. It had significant international repercussions, too.
So the crucial question is whether history might repeat itself.
Exactly. While Jackson's populism arguably ultimately strengthened American capitalism by decentralizing banking, the short-term turbulence was immense.
And the long-term effects now?
Well, the long-term effects of this current political pressure on the Fed could influence future monetary decision-making, potentially prioritizing short-term political gains over long-term market stability. And that's a significant risk for everyone.
Okay, shifting gears slightly, but staying with core economic policy. Tariffs. President Trump is, well, once again, making waves with his approach to trade.
Mm-hmm. Using tariffs as a kind of weaponized economic policy.
We're seeing new threats, especially concerning tech taxes. The president issued a direct threat.
Right. To impose substantial additional tariffs and export restrictions on our highly protected technology and chips.
Against countries that tax or regulate U.S. tech firms like Google and Meta.
Yeah, this is a consistent theme from the administration. We've seen similar threats before against Canada's digital tax proposal, a tariff investigation in Brazil.
European digital policies have also been a flashpoint.
They have. This new threat suggests an intensified focus on protecting U.S. tech interests abroad through, well, economic coercion.
And what's particularly striking, you mentioned, is how this aggressive approach could potentially conflict with their earlier decision.
Exactly. The decision to rescind Biden-era chip export limits. Semiconductor companies like NVIDIA and AMD had cheered those relaxations.
And now they face new uncertainties.
Right. This unpredictability for the industry is a real concern.
Beyond tech, the furniture industry is also under a direct tariff threat.
Mm-hmm.
Trump threatened additional tariffs on imported furniture.
To bring the furniture business back to the U.S., that was the stated goal.
How vulnerable are they, really? And what does this mean for you, the consumer?
Well, the furniture industry has already been adapting. Many sellers like Wayfair and RH shifted production out of China. They've also offset existing tariffs by negotiating with suppliers or raising prices. However, furniture is especially vulnerable to higher tariffs.
Why is that?
Because it's often a high-cost postponable purchase. And much of what's sold in the U.S. is heavily imported.
So if prices rise significantly,
consumers might just delay purchases.
Yeah.
Which could hurt the very businesses the tariffs are supposed to help. So yes, if you're eyeing a new couch, these policies could directly impact your wallet.
And speaking of consumer goods, coffee's also in the crosshairs. This is impacting Keurig Dr. Pepper, who just struck that big $18 billion deal for JDE Peet's.
Yeah, this deal is happening amid some challenging tariff specifics. The Trump administration implemented 50% import taxes on Brazilian goods, including coffee beans.
And Brazil's a huge producer, right?
Yeah.
So hard to avoid.
Incredibly difficult. Brazil is just such a dominant producer. Keurig Dr. Pepper already expects prominent impacts from these tariffs in the second half of the year.
Adding to inflation for consumers.
Adding to inflation and general consumer uncertainty, yeah.
Okay, finally on trade. Let's look at the broader relationship with China. We're seeing a bit of a nuanced dance there.
Mm-hmm. Top Chinese trade negotiator Li Qinggang is heading to the U.S. That signals a resumption of dialogue after a truce on higher tariffs until early November.
What's interesting is Trump's shifting tone. He seems to be focusing on an economic bargain, even floating a summit with Xi Jinping. He said, "We're going to have a great relationship with China."
Which highlights a desire for a more pragmatic, maybe deal-making approach.
But tensions still linger, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. The U.S. is still demanding increased American soybean purchases that hasn't been answered.
And Beijing, what do they want?
Beijing wants fentanyl-related tariffs removed and a loosening of tech sales restrictions. The Trump administration, meanwhile, wants concrete proposals for curbing fentanyl trafficking ingredients.
Okay, and here's where it gets really interesting. You mentioned China's move on U.S. graphics processing units, GPUs.
Yes, China's recent move to restrict and potentially ban U.S. GPUs, including NVIDIA's H20 chips, while it seems like a show of strength.
It's actually revealing a critical dependency.
Precisely, a dependency on American platform software and hardware synthesis. China framed it as strength, but analysts argue it's an admission of weakness.
Because their own foundries are behind.
Years behind, and Chinese AI firms prefer NVIDIA because of its CUDA software ecosystem.
Explain CUDA again.
It's a powerful platform allowing developers to write software harnessing NVIDIA's unique parallel processing. It's basically the de facto standard for advanced AI development globally.
So even with subsidies.
Adoption of domestic chips in China has been slow. It just exposes Beijing's reliance on the US AI ecosystem.
So it demonstrates this complex dance between economic leverage and national security, especially in tech.
Exactly. And it reveals China's deep-seated fear of technological dependence.
Okay, moving on to another key area for the administration, law and order. President Trump is pushing a tough-on-crime agenda. We're seeing federal overreach meeting local resistance.
A major part of this involves ending cashless bail.
He signed executive orders aiming to end it nationally, and specifically in Washington, D.C. It was a core campaign promise, right? To dismantle liberal crime policies.
Yes. And the DC orders are particularly aggressive. They direct Attorney General Pam Bondi to hold suspects in federal custody, potentially using emergency powers for jail holds.
And beyond DC, the threat is to withhold federal funds from cities with cashless bail policies.
Which immediately sparks debate. Critics argue it creates a two-tiered justice system based on wealth.
While proponents say it incentivizes court appearances and keeps suspected offenders off the streets.
Right. And there's also a separate order targeting flag desecration, aiming to revoke visas for non-citizens and prioritize prosecutions.
These actions extend to potential National Guard deployments, too, which are drawing significant resistance from cities.
Yeah. President Trump called Chicago a killing field and threatened to send the National Guard, similar to deployments we saw in D.C. and Los Angeles.
But Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker has vowed to challenge this.
He has, calling it unconstitutional and un-American, and saying he's prepared to go to court. This sets up a major legal and political clash.
What are the key constraints here? Legally?
Well, you have the Posse Comitatus Act. That's a federal law generally prohibiting the use of the military, including the National Guard when federalized, for domestic law enforcement.
How did Trump get around that in D.C. and L.A.?
DC is under federal control, so that's different. In Los Angeles, the justification cited threats to federal building.
And the political calculus is clear, too.
Oh, very. Criticizing blue cities appeals to Trump's base, while confronting him rallies Democratic leaders' bases.
Meanwhile, you look at New York City. They've cut violent crime to record lows. Now they're focusing on quality of life issues.
Right. Disorderly conduct, drug use, homeless encampments. Commissioner Jessica Tisch emphasizes this differs from Giuliani's 1990s broken windows approach.
How so?
It allows officer discretion rather than strict crackdowns. The goal is to improve residents' feeling of safety.
Which highlights how data Chicago's murders are down 32%, shootings 37% can diverge dramatically from public perception.
Exactly. And perception is often what these policies are ultimately targeting.
Another significant policy shift. The administration's immigration crackdown. It's having a historic impact on the labor market.
Yeah, we're seeing a really dramatic swing in immigration, a virtual halt in unauthorized crossings, stepped-up deportations.
To the point where some experts predict net immigration could be negative this year for the first time in decades.
It's possible, and this has a profound double-edged effect.
Okay, see.
In the short term, it helps keep unemployment low, currently 4.2%, but long term, it could severely limit the economy's potential growth and generate larger budget deficits.
Why?
Because the U.S. labor supply is increasingly dependent on immigrants, especially as baby boomers retire. Without new arrivals, sustainable job growth could plummet from an average of 155,000 non-farm jobs per month.
Down to what?
Down to maybe 24,000. That's a massive demographic and economic earthquake.
And specific sectors will feel it more acutely.
Oh, absolutely. Think landscaping, maids, construction, agriculture. Sectors heavily reliant on non-citizen workers could be severely affected.
And we're seeing the human cost of these policies play out in individual cases, like Kilmar Abrego Garcia's.
Yes, his case is quite complex. Mistakenly deported to an El Salvador prison, then returned to the U.S. only to be immediately arrested by ICE for human smuggling.
And now a federal judge in Maryland has temporarily blocked his re-deportation to Uganda, a country he has no ties to.
Correct. This just raises an important question about the profound tension between policy goals and real-world consequences.
Especially when data collection methods are under scrutiny. The administration isn't publishing deportation figures. The Census Bureau might be undercounting.
Right. And cases like Abrego Garcia's, with disputed allegations of gang membership, a previous judge's order blocking removal due to gang targeting, they just highlight the immense legal and humanitarian complexities.
It forces us to ask, how do we ensure policy doesn't lead to such individual tragedies?
And what mechanisms exist for accountability when it does? It's a critical question.
Okay, let's turn our attention now to Intel. And it's a rather tricky dance with the administration.
This really highlights a broader trend of government intervention in the private sector.
Intel's CEO, Lip-Bu Tan, was apparently fighting for his job just months into his tenure.
He was. President Trump publicly demanded his resignation over past ties to the Chinese military.
Which created a panic within Intel, I imagine.
Absolutely. Tan flew to Washington, prepped intensely, and had a successful hour-long meeting with President Trump and top officials like Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent.
And he managed to convince Trump.
Apparently so. Convinced him of his loyalty and Intel's crucial importance for U.S. chip manufacturing. Trump reportedly took a liking to Tan and backed off the demand for his ouster.
Leading to this unusual deal, the government taking a minority equity stake in Intel.
Yes, converting already awarded CHIPS Act grants into equity. Intel was the largest beneficiary of Biden's CHIPS Act, but the rollout was slow. Intel's finances struggled.
So this equity stake is an extraordinary measure.
It is, boosted also by an unexpected $2 billion investment from SoftBank, part of their strategy to bet on U.S. firms and appeal to Trump's America First agenda.
So this isn't just about Intel, it's part of a larger pattern.
It seems to be. And what's fascinating here is how this blurs traditional party lines on economic intervention.
Also.
This Intel deal is just the latest in a series of extraordinary interventions. Remember the golden share in Nippon Steel's takeover of U.S. Steel?
Right.
Or the deal where the federal government takes 15% of NVIDIA and AMD's chip sales to China in return for allowing exports? And the Defense Department taking a minority stake in MP Materials, the rare earth magnets maker.
Some critics are calling it socialism with an R next to its name.
Exactly. It showcases a pragmatic, maybe America First approach that transcends ideological purity.
So for you, our listener, this fundamentally redefines the line between government and industry.
It does. What does this mean for the future of American manufacturing, technological leadership, and even the principles of market capitalism when the government becomes a direct equity holder? Big questions. Two, the digital world. Tech, AI, and society.
Okay, from the high-stakes world of national security and economic policy, let's shift our gaze. Another arena where data and privacy are colliding, sometimes literally, over our home.
But first, let's explore some major shifts in the digital world itself, starting with AI and politics.
Which is rapidly evolving. We're seeing lobbying efforts, lawsuits, new business models.
Yeah, Silicon Valley is now launching significant pro-AI PACs. There is a new super PAC network leading the future.
Backed by over $100 million from players like Andreessen Horowitz and OpenAI president Greg Brockman.
That's right. It's a clear signal that tech executives are becoming highly active politically.
What are their main goals?
Primarily to advocate against strict AI regulations, pushing back against what some call the AI doomer movement, which worries about catastrophic risk.
Okay, so they want industry-friendly policies.
Exactly. Supporting candidates who foster those policies. This network hopes to emulate the success of Fairshake, that crypto-focused PAC that influenced last year's elections.
And it highlights a swing in Silicon Valley towards conservatives, which worries Democrats.
Understandably so, yes.
Beyond lobbying, we're seeing legal battles too. Elon Musk's xAI suing both Apple and OpenAI, alleging they're monopolists.
The core claim is that Apple's partnership with OpenAI gives ChatGPT an unfair advantage. by providing access to billions of user prompts from iPhones. Musk claims this data improves ChatGPT's model and that Apple then deprioritizes rival chatbots in its app store.
What's the defense?
Apple says its app store is unbiased. They partner with the best products. OpenAI calls it Musk's ongoing pattern of harassment.
And this ties into the idea of a super app threat, that AI could eventually threaten Apple's core business.
Potentially. If AI companies achieve greater scale, their services could become so useful. Apple executives themselves have acknowledged this disruptive potential. One even testified, "You may not need an iPhone in 10 years."
Wow. Okay, in terms of new business models, we're also seeing Perplexity, an AI startup launching a revenue share model for publishers.
Yes, they plan to pay publishers from an initial $42.5 million pool when their articles are used to answer queries. They aim to increase this amount over time.
This addresses a major complaint from publishers, doesn't it? AI firms using their content without compensation.
It does, directly. This is an entirely new News Corp, and the New York Times already have content deals with AI firms.
So what's different here?
Perplexity's move to share subscription revenue represents an attempt to create a more symbiotic relationship.
So for you, our listener, what does this mean for the future of journalism and content creation in the AI era?
Will AI be a destroyer or a benefactor? It suggests a future where content creators might increasingly negotiate direct compensation for their IP, shifting from reliance on traffic-driven ad revenue
to a model where the value of their content for AI training and answering queries is recognized and paid for.
Exactly. It could be a significant shift.
All right, next up in the digital world, digital security and privacy. Navigating some new frontiers here. Let's talk about passkeys, hailed as the future of login.
Mm-hmm. The idea is they work using a pair of unique mathematical values, a private key stored securely on your device,
okay,
and a public key stored on the website or app you're connecting to.
So when you log in,
the site or app determines if you have the correct private key authenticating you, authorized by your master password, PI, face scan, or fingerprint.
The big promise is eliminating the hassle of complex passwords. Safer, easier logins.
That's the goal. But here's where it gets really interesting. While passkeys promise a significant leap in convenience and security, their widespread adoption and seamless interoperability are still very much a work in progress. It highlights the inherent challenges in unifying fragmented tech ecosystems.
Like syncing across different platforms, Apple, Android, Windows.
Exactly. That can be a hassle. And currently, you generally can't transfer passkeys directly between different password managers.
Though a new standard is coming.
A new FIDO standard called Credential Exchange is in development to address that.
So we can't just move them around easily yet. What about security concerns? Like if you lose your device?
It's vital to take the same precautions as for any sensitive data. Sync your passkeys, lock your device with a strong passcode, enable auto erase, use remote wipe features.
And if you're locked out?
Having them on multiple devices helps. Or using biometrics. Many third-party apps also provide recovery codes you should store safely.
But adoption is still low.
Yeah, only 329 sites listed support them. 31 of the top 100 U.S. sites. So we're still in the early stages.
Yeah.
But the ability to have multiple passkeys for one account could eventually help bridge those OS divides.
Another significant development online: the push for age verification rules to protect children.
Right. Lawmakers are increasingly pressuring tech companies to verify users' ages to limit access for under 18s. New laws emerging in the UK, several US states like Texas, Utah, Mississippi.
This must present substantial challenges for tech companies. How are they doing it?
They're using a variety of technologies. Government-issued photo IDs, but those are vulnerable to fakes.
Mm-hmm.
Parental permission for child accounts, but that's hard to verify. Video selfies used by Meta and TikTok sent to third-party providers, but those face challenges with image quality, deepfakes, user error.
And AI guessing age based on activity.
Google and Meta use that too. The core dilemma is achieving accuracy without excessive data collection, especially concerning broader legislation like the Kids Online Safety Act.
So for you, our listener, these rules will definitely affect online experiences for families and individuals.
Absolutely. Balancing safety with convenience and privacy is the key challenge here.
Now let's look at something else flying high above our heads. Literally. Flying cameras for insurers.
Yeah, airborne cameras, drones, balloons, robot camera systems from companies like Near Space Labs snapping photos of individual houses across the U.S.
What's the purpose?
It's dual purpose, really. Primarily, insurers inspect buildings after extreme weather, but they also use these photos to determine which homes are too risky to insure.
Leading to non-renewals.
Potentially, yes. This has raised alarm among some consumers who weren't aware their homes were being photographed from above.
California is proposing a bill about this.
Requiring insurers to notify policyholders if aerial photos could be taken and explain how to get copies. Consumer groups argue it doesn't go far enough. They want insurers to proactively provide date-stamped photos.
How do insurers defend this?
They argue it's the most cost-effective way to assess properties, especially after disasters like wildfires, and they view their withdrawal from high-risk areas as an important signal for potential home buyers.
So for you, our listener, this means considering how aerial surveillance might affect your homeowner's insurance, your privacy.
And even your future housing choices, especially in areas prone to extreme weather. It's another layer of data collection impacting our lives.
Now for a fascinating intersection: politics, finance, and emerging technology. Let's discuss Eric Trump. He's become a crypto evangelist.
Surprisingly so, yes. Deeply involved in the family business's ventures into this space. It's quite a transformation from his self-proclaimed bricks and mortar guy identity.
What drove this evolution?
As he describes it, it was heavily influenced by the experience of the Trump Organization being debanked after January 6, 2021. Several banks allegedly cut off services without explicit reason.
And he felt the financial system was fragile, weaponized.
That's what he stated. He said he realized how fragile the financial system was and how easily it could be weaponized against you.
This issue of debanking for political reasons has become a rallying cry in conservative circles.
It has, and a central point of the Trump administration's agenda, leading to an executive order directing regulators to investigate and punish banks for such discrimination.
And the Trump family is now deeply involved in crypto, mining tokens.
Deeply. Bitcoin mining and acquisition, other crypto tokens. A flagship firm, World Liberty Financial, recently valued at $4.5 billion, launched a WLFI token and a stablecoin.
Attracting high-profile investors, like Justin Sun.
Yes, the Chinese crypto billionaire and Aqua One Foundation, a UAE-based company. Eric Trump was even appointed a director for ALT5 Sigma, a publicly traded crypto payments firm that acquired WLFI
And
tokens.
he defends things like the Trump baby meme coin.
He does, calls it a gateway to financial freedom. He suggests real-world assets like Trump Tower could even be tokenized.
This raises an important question, doesn't it, about the confluence of politics, finance, and emerging tech.
Absolutely. And the ethical considerations that arise when prominent political families engage so heavily in rapidly evolving, often less regulated markets.
So for you, our listener, how might these developments influence the regulatory landscape for crypto?
And what are the implications for transparency and potential conflicts of interest in public life? These are critical questions to watch. Three, global flashpoints in geopolitics: conflict, diplomacy, and humanitarian crises.
Okay, shifting now to global affairs. Let's look at some critical flashpoints and geopolitical developments, starting with the ongoing Ukraine-Russia conflict.
We're seeing Russia facing significant fuel rationing.
Because of Ukraine's drone campaign against Russian refineries.
Yes, it's reportedly taken about 13% of Russia's fuel production offline, and Western sanctions are limiting Moscow's ability to repair that infrastructure.
This is more than just an inconvenience for Russia, isn't it?
Oh, much more. The frequent disruptions to rail networks, airports, they're forcing more road travel during peak times like summer holidays and the harvest season. Fuel demand spikes.
Leading to rationing in places like Crimea and Siberia.
Exactly. And wholesale prices for 95-octane gasoline have surged 45% this year. The IMF even cut Russia's GDP forecast for 2025 to just 0.9%.
So while not directly military, these strikes create bottlenecks.
And multiply problems inside that system, as former Ukrainian FM Pavel Klinkin put it. It impacts the broader Russian economy.
And Ukraine is using more potent drones now, like the Flamingo cruise missile.
Yes, they're able to carry out sustained attacks and significantly increasing their capacity to inflict damage.
A core aspect of this conflict remains Ukraine's refusal to give up Donetsk, despite Putin's demands.
Well, Putin's demand for the entire Donetsk region, including the 25% still under Ukrainian control, despite his inability to easily conquer it, that's actually a sign of weakness.
How so?
Ukraine has built a heavily reinforced defensive line, the Fortress Belt, over a decade. Its 31 miles long, historically repelled Russian advances. Penetrating it by force would take years.
And Ukraine's refusal stems from past betrayals.
Painful lessons learned, yes. The 1994 Budapest Memorandum, where they gave up nuclear weapons. The 2014 Ilovaise ambush, where a supposed humanitarian corridor became a massacre.
So Ukrainian officials are resolute. They won't exit the war even without U.S. support, fearing genocide.
That's what they state. They fear mass genocidal extermination. And they question whether a European coalition of the willing would be effective without strong U.S. backing, given Russia's history of violating ceasefires.
And there's this perceived contradiction from President Trump regarding Russia and Ukraine. He's criticized Biden,
saying Biden would not let Ukraine fight back, only defend.
But the journal reports an inconsistency. Trump's Pentagon preventing Ukraine from using U.S. ATACMS missiles for long-range strikes into Russia.
Exactly. Which directly contradicts his take-the-gloves-off rhetoric. It raises questions about who is truly setting U.S.-Ukraine policy. Is it Trump or Pentagon officials like Elbridge Colby?
Calls for a maximum pressure strategy to force Putin to negotiate.
Yes. And for you, our listener, these internal policy debates and military tactics profoundly influence the war's trajectory and regional stability. They determine whether the conflict escalates or moves towards some kind of resolution.
Moving now to the Middle East. A severe humanitarian crisis marked by that recent Israeli strike on a Gaza hospital.
Yes, at least 20 people killed, including 5 journalists, medical staff, patients, rescue workers.
The details are stark. 2 strikes, one hitting the building, the second hitting rescue crews.
That's what's reported. Footage from Jordan's Al Ghad TV reportedly confirms the second strike on rescuers. Among the confirmed dead, Miriam Daga, AP, Mohammed Salama, Al Jazeera, Hussam al-Masri, Reuters contractor.
And foreign journalists are still prohibited from entering Gaza independently.
Correct. President Trump's reaction was, I'm not happy about it. I don't want to see it. At the same time, we have to end that whole nightmare.
Meanwhile, Netanyahu authorized plans to invade Gaza City amidst international condemnation.
And a breakdown in ceasefire talks, yes.
And the day-to-day struggle for survival in Gaza. It's truly dire.
It is. A global body, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, has officially declared famine conditions in northern Gaza. That's the first such determination in the Middle East.
Gazans describe scavenging for food, risking fire at aid sites.
Burning rubble for cooking fires. Hala Al-Kamouni, a mother whose story was shared, lost 3 children in an airstrike, lives in a tent, struggles daily for food, relies on cash apps from relatives.
And Israel overhauled the aid system, replacing the UN-led approach.
With the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, GHF, which has reportedly resulted in hundreds of deaths and injuries at its distribution sites, though Israel disputes the figures.
It's just a stark portrayal of a severe humanitarian crisis.
Highlighting the immense daily challenges faced by millions and the critical need for effective humanitarian aid amidst ongoing conflict.
In a significant development in international crime, Mexican cartel patriarch Ismael El Mayo Zambada pleaded guilty to U.S. drug charges.
Yes, the 77-year-old Sinaloa cartel leader pleaded guilty to 2 counts of drug trafficking in Brooklyn federal court, facing a mandatory life term.
He led the cartel for nearly 40 years, smuggling tons of drugs.
Cocaine, heroin, methamphetamines, fentanyl. Attorney General Pam Bondi stated bluntly, he will die in a U.S. federal prison where he belongs.
Does this plea open up the potential for cooperation? Trading information.
There's considerable speculation. Could he trade info on high-level Mexican officials' involvement in drug trafficking for a lighter sentence or better prison conditions?
A U.S. Justice Department report highlighted corruption as key to his control.
Exactly, suggesting he has valuable insights. His lawyer denies cooperation, but the possibility remains significant.
His capture last year was dramatic too, wasn't it? Lured out and ambushed by El Chapo's son.
Yes, Joaquin Guzman Lopez, which sparked a brutal civil war within the Sinaloa cartel.
So for you, our listener, this story offers a glimpse into the complex, violent world of international drug trafficking.
And its deep intersection with political power. It's a dark reality for economic and business trends, markets, industries, and consumer behavior.
All right, let's pivot now to some broader economic and business trends, starting with a topic that often sparks, well, heated debate, the tax that billionaires actually pay.
Mm-hmm. A new study using anonymized IRS data has offered some compelling findings.
It estimates the 400 wealthiest Americans paid, what was it, 23.8% of their economic income in taxes from 2018-2020.
That's the figure. And what's particularly insightful is that nearly 40% of their total taxes came from the corporate income tax, effectively paid at source.
Which contrasts sharply with the Biden administration's claim of 8.2%, because that didn't include corporate taxes.
Correct. The reason for the discrepancy is how the ultra-wealthy derive income, mostly from private company profits and shares of public corporations, not typically taxed individually until shares are sold or dividends received.
So this study tries to give a more comprehensive estimate by including those corporate profits and taxes.
Exactly. Now, while corporate tax serves as a progressive tool for taxing the wealthy, policymakers worry about its effect on economic growth.
Right. And corporate taxes are a blunt tool. They affect 401k holders too.
They do. They impact the broader economy. So for you, our listener, this information challenges common perceptions about how much the ultra-wealthy contribute in taxes.
And it directly informs those broader economic policy debates.
Precisely.
Turning to housing, retail, and real estate. We have a rather unusual story. Dillard's, the department store, is buying a mall.
Yeah, most department stores are leaving malls, but Dillard's, with a partner, purchased Longview Mall in Texas for $34 million.
Is this a sign of a retail comeback? Or something more specific?
It seems more like a strategic move for Dillard's. The motivation, they say, is to ensure the mall is well maintained, combating what their co-CFO called bad actors who let properties deteriorate.
Protecting their own anchor store's environment.
Exactly. Department stores historically played an integral role in mall ownership. This is an effort to regain some control.
So for you, our listener, is this a localized retail comeback?
Or simply a smart defensive play by a department store deeply embedded in that specific property? Probably the latter, but interesting nonetheless.
Meanwhile, in China, property stocks are powering up, driven by stimulus hopes.
Yes. Shanghai authorities recently waived property taxes for first-time buyers and lifted purchase restrictions in suburban areas.
Which sharply boosted Chinese property stocks, reinforcing expectations of more policy support for the sector.
Right. Developer China Vanke stock jumped 15%, despite reporting a drop in revenue and a widened loss. That reflects optimism about liquidity support.
But analysts are still cautious, expecting a slow recovery.
Very cautious. Expecting a slow recovery, with some developers likely remaining loss-making until 2027.
So for you, our listener, this tells us about the Chinese economy's health.
Particularly its ongoing efforts to stabilize its property sector and the potential ripple effects on global markets and investor confidence.
Next, let's look at the agricultural sector. Farmers are under pressure.
Despite expecting their largest corn crop ever due to good weather.
Many in the Corn Belt anticipate barely breaking even, or even losing money.
It's a classic double-edged sword for farmers. High yields lead to low prices, currently around $3.90 per bushel, a five-year low.
Making it incredibly difficult for cash-strapped farmers to turn a profit.
Yeah, Charon Giesling, an Ohio farmer profiled, describes the emotional and financial struggles being unable to pay back operating loans.
Hopes for lower input costs and favorable regulations haven't fully materialized?
Not fully. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act allocated $59 billion to farm safety net programs like crop insurance over 10 years. And there are calls for renewing the farm bill for certainty.
So for you, our listener, this highlights the complex challenges in agriculture.
Where abundance doesn't always mean prosperity, and the critical role of government policy in sustaining these vital operations.
Finally, let's explore America's newest auto plant, Hyundai's ultra-modern facility near Savannah, Georgia. Full of robots, but still needing the human touch.
Yeah, it operates with a 750 robots to 1,450 people ratio. A stark contrast to the U.S. auto industry average, which is more like seven people to one robot.
So this plant is a fascinating illustration of advanced manufacturing's evolving balance.
Absolutely. Robots handle material movement, welding, even inspections using dog-like robots.
But humans are still essential for tasks requiring tactile feel.
Like spotting burrs, snapping panels into place, connecting electrical components, bolting down seats. Hyundai's CEO emphasizes maximizing human potential.
By having robots handle the dangerous, repetitive, or physically demanding jobs.
Leaving troubleshooting, quality monitoring, and craftsmanship to people, while incoming employers worry about robots displacing jobs.
Hyundai committed to hiring 8,500 people by 2031, with higher starting wages.
They did. Ultimately, humans still hold primary responsibility for quality control and final test drives, providing that crucial seal of approval.
So for you, our listener, this is a fantastic illustration of the evolving balance between automation and human labor.
And what it means for the future of work and advanced manufacturing. V culture, lifestyle, and human interests, society's pulse and personal stories.
All right, let's delve into some fascinating aspects of culture, lifestyle, and human interest now, kicking off with an intriguing discussion on parenting and personal finance.
We're looking at a novel approach to saving for the future adult.
Exemplified by parents Leza and Anthony Dealey, saving $1,000 a month for their 7-year-old daughter Zoe, but not for college.
Right. It's to support her as an otherwise independent adult at age 30.
What's the motivation there?
It's driven by the parents' own experiences. Leza graduated during the 2007-09 recession, struggled with debt, unstable jobs, wants to prevent that for Zoe.
This reflects a broader trend: rising rents, college costs, scarce entry-level jobs, making it harder for younger generations.
Exactly. Financial advisors confirm the need is greater for this kind of intergenerational support.
Though funneling cash to adult children is a luxury and can cause issues.
It can. Arguments stunting development, but for those with the means, there's growing acceptance. The Dealey's calculated saving around $2,000 a month now could yield about $3,000 a month for Zoe's adult life after college.
Sometimes called inheritance flipping, helping kids earlier in life.
Precisely. Helping when I'm still around, when it's earlier in their life and they need it more.
So for you, our listener, this offers a unique perspective on evolving family financial dynamics.
And the intergenerational transfer of wealth, prompting you to consider your own financial planning and family support strategies.
Next, let's examine corporate branding and culture wars. Specifically, the firestorm around Cracker Barrel's recent logo change.
Yeah, they replaced their longtime logo, the man in overalls, with a more streamlined version, part of an All the More campaign to update the brand, attract younger guests.
And it ignited a swift backlash.
Oh, yeah. Accusations of eschewing its country charm, calls for boycotts. Figures like Donald Trump Jr. sharing criticism. CEO Julie Fels-Masino personally targeted.
Did it impact their value?
Initially shaved tens of millions off their market value, but the stock is still up 32% over the past 12 months. So, a complex impact.
How did Cracker Barrel respond?
They apologized for communication, but defended the changes as honoring legacy while bringing new energy.
We've seen this before, haven't we? Bud Light, Target. Companies caught in culture war crossfire.
It's becoming more common. Masino, the CEO, is trying to transform Cracker Barrel, address declining sales, improve food, value, experience.
So for you, our listener, how do companies navigate tradition versus modernization in this polarized landscape?
And what's the real long-term impact of these culture war boycotts on their bottom line and brand identity? It's tough territory.
Now, for a lighter note in sports and entertainment, a unique narrative about baseball organists.
Ah, yes, a dying art form, but still alive thanks to figures like 78-year-old Mancy Faust, who played for the White Sox for over 40 years.
What are the unique skills involved?
Deep commitment to research, an eye for musical puns like playing Flight of the Bumblebee during a B delay, or you can't sit down for George Brett after his hemorrhoid surgery.
Huh. And instant recall without sheet music.
Exactly. It's a fun, nostalgic look at how creativity still plays a role in live sports.
A reminder that some traditions, because they're human and imperfect, still capture our hearts.
Well said.
Then we have a truly epic U.S. Open tennis meltdown, featuring Russian star Daniil Medvedev.
An outburst at an umpire, the crowd joining in.
What?
During a first-round match at the booziest major.
What happened?
Late Sunday night, rogue photographer runs onto the court. Umpire controversially awards Medvedev's opponent another first serve at match point.
And Medvedev erupted.
Demanded of the umpire, "Are you a man? Why are you shaking?" Broadcast his accusations into the TV camera. The crowd, already lubricated, began booing, which Medvedev encouraged.
He's known for a short fuse.
Notoriously so. He used the crowd's energy. For you, our listener, it perfectly illustrates what happens when player emotion, crowd energy, and controversial calls collide in high-stakes sports.
And a heartwarming story of perseverance from golf. Tommy Fleetwood finally broke his streak.
After 163 starts on the PGA Tour without a win, he snapped it at the PGA Tour Championship, winning $10 million.
He was an extreme outlier. $33 million in career earnings without a win.
Incredible, yes. And remarkably, he became a fan favorite by losing, endearing himself with candid reactions to past nightmares.
Despite a double bogey near the end, he secured the victory.
And fellow golfers celebrated his success. A truly inspiring story of perseverance, the emotional roller coaster of pro sports.
And that unique connection athletes can have with fans who appreciate the struggle.
Absolutely.
Finally, in arts and culture, Criterion Collection released 4K restorations of two films by the great Taiwanese director Edward Yang.
Yes, Confusion and Mahjong. Yang was a central figure in new Taiwanese cinema, known for patient observation, nuanced realism, striking compositions, exploring complex Taipei realities.
The Confusion is a satire. Mahjong, a darker crime story.
Correct. His 1994 note for a confusion about shared humanity is quite poignant.
And a quick look at the week's arts calendar.
New films like The Roses, Caught Stealing, Music from the Beaches, Blood Orange, Sabrina Carpenter, art exhibitions including the Seoul Mediacity Biennale.
So for you, our listener, a chance to discover significant cinema and stay updated on cultural events.
Enriching your appreciation for diverse artistic expressions.
Lastly, let's explore some diverse perspectives from the opinion and commentary sections. A commentary titled, Back to School is the Cruelest Time of Year, really resonated.
Mm-hmm. Reflecting on that melancholic feeling of summer's end, connecting it to memento mori, the fleeting nature of life's good things.
It's a relatable piece, isn't it? Tapping into universal emotions tied to seasonal transitions.
And that inherent anxiety, often accompanying the end of one period, the start of another, reminds us how personal experiences shape our perceptions.
Another piece reviews Daniel J. Flynn's book, The Man Who Invented Conservatism, focusing on Frank S. Meyer.
Meyer developed fusionism, reconciling traditionalist and libertarian principles in the post-war American right.
His journey from caviar communist to influential conservative intellectual.
It's fascinating. Fusionism tried to marry respect for institutions and order with defense of individual liberty, spread through late-night calls in books like In Defense of Freedom.
But the article notes, conservatives have struggled to maintain this balance, leading to the unruly right.
Yes. For you, our listener, this provides crucial historical context for understanding the evolution of political ideologies and their inherent tensions.
Finally, an opinion piece. Expanding Medicaid hasn't improved U.S. healthcare. A challenging perspective.
It argues that despite more people having insurance via Medicaid expansion, it hasn't led to significant healthcare improvements.
What are the key arguments?
Many new enrollees are healthy, don't need care. Those who get sick can easily re-enroll retroactively. Enrollees place low value on coverage. Studies like the Oregon Health Insurance Experiment found no significant physical health improvement.
And it talks about phantom ACA patients.
Yeah.
Fraudulent signups.
Claiming they contribute to high enrollment numbers without corresponding healthcare usage. For you, our listener, this piece challenges common assumptions about healthcare access and outcomes.
Encouraging critical thinking about public policy effectiveness.
And the nuanced relationship between coverage and actual health improvement.
Wow. That was an incredibly comprehensive journey through today's Wall Street Journal.
It really was.
From the high-stakes political movers in Washington to the deeply personal stories of struggle and triumph around the globe, it's clear the world is moving at a breakneck pace.
It certainly is. What stands out to me today is this persistent tension we see across so many articles between central authority and individual agency.
Yeah, how so?
Whether it's the government stepping into private industry or tech companies balancing user privacy with new regulations, or even just the individual farmer navigating massive economic forces. That tension is everywhere.
That's a great point. And for you, our listener, I hope this deep dive has offered more than just a summary.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you found those surprising connections and moments of clarity that help make sense of our complex world.
We hope so.
Before we go, here's a final thought for you to chew on. If the rise of new technologies and shifting global powers are increasingly blurring the lines between what is public and what is private.
Yeah.
How much control do you truly have over your own information, your own economic future, and even your own perception of safety?
Indeed. It's a question that resonates from the discussions about your data being used by AI to your home being photographed from above.
Right.
And even to the very financial planning your family undertakes for future generations. It touches everything.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt.
And I'm Sam Astor. We look forward to exploring the next set of sources with you soon.